and welcome to this new edition of the CCUR Ratings Radar Show. I'm Richard Lander. My co-host is Angus Foote. And our data mavens are Frank Talbot and Nisha Long. And just to continue the series of looking at distinguished individual fund managers, which we're doing for the time being, we're going to talk about someone who's got amazingly high and consistent CCUR ratings. His name is Mike Fox, and he comes from Royal London Asset Management, based in London, as you would guess. And Nisha Long is going to tell us more about him. So welcome, Nisha.
Hi, Richard. Yes, as you mentioned, Mike Fox, Royal London CityWire AAA rated manager consistently for the past 13 months and has been consistently rated since February 2013. Now, in that time, it's just one tiny blip in 2017. But you know what? This is a really impressive run from a very successful manager. Now, he is one of the longest serving managers in the sustainable investment space. And before all the hype of ESG investing really began. And that's why I want to talk about him today, because, you know, ESG investing has been going on for a long time. And he is one of those people who have, you know, embraced it, you know, for decades, and how sustainable investing, you know, works in the long term. So he currently has four funds under management. It's a mix of global equities. He's also got mixed assets in there on an aggressive side, a balanced side, UK or companies. So a bit of everything for different risk profiling, matching for investors, which, you know, which is great that you do need that those differences. Now, he was recently, I think this is quite interesting, he has been, you know, recently joined on these funds by two co-managers since 2020, Sebastian Begulin and George Cowdy. So they joined him on in 2020. Now, this could be succession planning or trying to eliminate key person risks, because after all, he is, you know, if you look at his credentials, he is a star manager and he's always delivered over the long term. So I just want to concentrate on one of his funds for the purposes of this podcast. I want to look at the Sustainable Leaders Fund. The fund is around £3.2 billion pounds in size. You know, it's not small fish we're talking about here. You know, it's continuously taking in money in, you know, not masses, but it's still, you know, just last year, £500 million went in. So it is really on the radar of investors. So what he looks at in all of his funds is companies that have a benefit to society through their products or their services, and they must have good ESG credentials. We've heard about all that, you know, ESG credentials all the time, but he's been looking at this for a very long time. And what I find impressive about his investment style and processes is that out of the 18 years that he has managed this fund, he's just had four negative return periods, only four out of all that time. And it is the years that you kind of expect that to happen anyway, you know, with, because it was market wide, and that's why his fund went down. So 2007, we had the China stock bubble then. 2008, don't need to say more, global financial crisis. 2011, now this is, you know, the euro debt crisis, which did kind of go into, you know, the equity markets, but also the S&P did have a short-lived bear market in that year. And then 2018, you know, President Trump, trade war with China did hit his fund. It is like a global fund as well. You know, some of the stocks are international, and also there were concerns of Fed rate rises as well. So, but he held his own in all of those periods and lost less than some of his peers in that sector, those sectors. So
nice.
So far, yeah, I think he's absolutely great in those kind of, especially those kind of markets. So this year, as you all know, you know, it's all been about energy and financials. You know, they've been performing the best this year, since the start of this year. But this is a sustainable fund, and understandably, he doesn't have energy, as in the dirty energy stocks, as we'd call them, in oil, gas, etc., and avoids mining companies. Again, you'd understand that to happen, and also underweights resources. Now, this has slightly hit his performance last year and a bit into this year, but he's still producing the goods, you know, with his stock picks in other well-diversified areas. You know, these are short-term blips, and, you know, this is one for the long term. And I think just the emphasis of that point, that if you can stomach the bouts of volatility, especially with these sustainable funds, you know, it is a long-term game. So it's one of those funds that you just hold in your pension, for example, for a long time, leave it alone. You know, he'll do the job for you in that riding, you know, these market cycles. But he's very proactive, a very proactive, active manager. So in terms of ESG, so a decade back, he was looking at negative screening. So he's avoiding tobacco, mining, you know, armaments, etc. And now he's actually shifted that focus onto positive screening, and which is, you know, finding companies which have good ESG credentials, but it is relative to the peers that he's looking at. And this has opened up the investment universe for him, because if you think about sustainable investing, you do sometimes have, you know, that the universe has shrunk because of all the things that you need to take out of that portfolio if it doesn't have the credentials. So, you know, this portfolio itself is quite concentrated. Over its lifetime, it's had 40 to 50 stocks. At the moment, it just has 41 stocks. You know, so it's very high conviction areas that he goes into and, you know, taking out these selections. But as I said, you know, he moves with the times. He did have US tech stocks, especially, you know, for many years actually. But in 2018, he did reduce those. Now, that might have hit him a bit in 2020, but having said that, you know, he did the right thing because he felt that, you know, it wasn't with his strategy, especially with data privacy, for example. So, you know, got rid of some.
Yeah, it's cushioned him. No, it's interesting. You sold it very well. You didn't need to for me because I've got some already. And you know, I did buy it a few years ago and noticed how tech heavy it was. And it brings us to the question. I don't know if Angus and Frank, you know, have got s stuff to say on this. You know, why are tech companies ESG? Because you know, they connected the world. They played a huge part in getting us through the pandemic, I guess. But are they really ESG happy stocks?
That's a huge question. Are they ESG? On many metrics, they're some of the least offensive companies that you can buy and you can access. But as ever, ESG is a massive journey as we learn more about what it means, where the offensive parts of the global economy really are. That's when they're getting caught up. Your companies like Microsoft, you know, the whole right to repair movement that's sort of made Apple come out and say they're now going to give you the chance to. Third parties to repair their iPhones, a sort of a landmark moment. They're doing that because they know the regulation's coming, because they know they do need to clean up their act. There are aspects of their business practices that aren't as whiter than white. Obviously, the social impact of something like Facebook and knowing what you do online better than what you do and serving you that content, the whole way in which it's positioned, I think, you know, it needs some overarching regulation to get into the weeds of that. But in terms of their carbon footprint outside of e-waste, they're actually pretty inoffensive, which is why they've screened so well historically, and while they're in virtually every ESG portfolio there is. I mean, Nisha mentioned he uses his international exposure, so it's a UK equity fund, but he's got up to 20% he can buy overseas, and he has got Microsoft, he has got Adidas, a few select companies, Texas Instruments as well, that he feels sort of serve that well. Angus, you want to come in?
Well, I was going to say, I think that if we talk about ESG friendly stocks, we are already well behind the curve on this, because I don't think anyone sophisticated is thinking about ESG friendly stocks anymore. The three things actually that I scribbled down while you guys were talking. And firstly, Frank, you mentioned carbon footprint. So carbon footprint is the E. It's, you know, that's all about environment and climate. So one point is that increasingly these three things are separate. ES and G are not the same thing. They've been lumped together for reasons of convenience. There's a lot of talk, you know, a lot of what's happening is around the E because climate is seen as the most pressing issue and because there's regulation and government policy. S kind of creeping up a bit. Governance should always have been there. One of the things that I've been hearing a lot about is the fact that E requires a shift in capital. The other two largely require a change in process and thinking. They don't require a massive reallocation of capital, which the climate thing does. Second point, when you talk about an ESG friendly company, most ESG scoring systems are entirely backward looking. And a couple of people made the point to me recently that actually, if you're looking for a company that really understands the need to transition to do things differently in future, In many cases, the companies that understand that the best are the ones that have just had a major blow up. So if you've been through some terrible pollution related scandal, then you're going to make very, very sure you put processes in place to make sure that doesn't happen again. So
also your competitors within your industry, they see it and they start to clean up their act because they know they could be next.
That's true, Frank. True. But I mean, this is what I'm hearing from the market, that a lot of people feel that, you know, some of the companies that are doing the most to change are the ones that have been through, you know, something traumatic. And one final point is risk adjusted return. You know, people increasingly are not talking about, you know, ESG as a conceptual investment. They're saying, you know, these are risks. So what I want is a manager who delivers good risk-adjusted return. Part of doing that is considering and building in the risks that relate to what we are, you know, so far have called ESG. So
it's just stranded assets.
Well, but yeah, but regardless of whether stranded assets or anything else, you should look at everything with a thorough, you know, risk-based assessment of the prospects of that stock. And a key part of that in future will relate to climate, to the social factors, and of course, always to governance.
Nisha.
Yeah, so I mean, you mentioned the rating agencies as well. Yes, it is a concern that is all backward looking. And also the way they do the analysis is based, as you mentioned, the risk is based on risk. How much risk are you putting in your company? So just to give you an example, you know, if you have reputational damage that is under the S, that will affect the financial materiality of the company. That affects your bottom line. And in ESG terms, that is called the triple bottom line. You know, this all has effects on your, if your product's being recalled. Again, that's an S factor within this. You know, so I think, and I have mentioned it before, I think E of ESG has been taken care of, you know, very well in the ESG world. S is really lacking. And I think that is where most of your returns can come from. For example, you know, when you are looking at transitioning, for example, like BP, and you mentioned that they did have, you know, the deep water horizon, you know, crisis that they had. But what they're doing now is, you know, one example is they're partnering with a Scottish city, Aberdeen, to get a clean energy in process. They've partnered with BP to help them with that transition to make it an effective clean energy city, which I thought, you know, they're transitioning this way. And a lot of investments of these big energy companies are going towards, you know, these kind of programs that they're doing around the world. So even though you see that, you know, okay, they've still got their oils and gas, but this transition process is going to take decades. It's not going to happen overnight. As long as we can see through their balance sheets where that investment is going, how much they are actually, you know, it's not going into their reserve capitals. They're actually using that money to get to this transition. I think that's the ones, you know, you need to start looking at in this. I know that Mike Fox doesn't have this kind of energy, but he does have, you know, clean energy stocks within his portfolio, which are involved in, you know, the transitioning process as well. So, you know, there is, you know, more to go in this area.
Does he do this? I get the impression, I might be wrong, that he does this on a case-by-case, stock-by-stock basis, rather than putting any of these things through the screens, with the obvious exception that he's not going to go for guns, tobacco and energy.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, as with any manager, he has the screens as well and the ESG screens. He is a bottom-up stock picker, so he is starting at, you know, the company level. But as with all you know, managers, we have seen, you know, some shifts. He still will look at themes as well, like he did in 2020. It was, you know, the pharma, that, you know, the healthcare, tech stocks, those kind of things that you were still looking at the time. But ultimately, he is a bottom-up stock picker and will, you know, really look at the credentials of the company through his ESG screens. As I mentioned, he has made a shift from negative to positive screening, you know, over the time. So he's evolving, you know, as we get to know more of the metrics that we need to know, which I think is great. He's been in this game for decades, but he is moving with, you know, what's available as well.
Frank, are you coming in there?
Yeah, I mean, I was just coming back to Mike again, that Nisha's assessment of his long-term performance is absolutely, you know, on the money. He was, when I joined the company in 2006, he was the individual globally delivering the highest amount of outperformance of any manager we tracked. And he did have that difficult period in 2008 crisis. Then obviously the rallying bank sectors, he didn't fare particularly well on stuff that he was already excluding, and companies that he didn't think were right to put his money with. And has had just a phenomenal run. What I found really interesting about his biggest positions is Only two of his top 20, as far as I can tell, have been initiated in the pandemic. So he's not changing things around at all, right? These are long-term buy and hold stakes. They were Greggs and Compass Group, so both involved in the UK food industry. I found that to be very interesting. Just a note on performance year to date has been bad. Nisha did talk about this, down 7.4%, whereas, believe it or not, the FTSE is actually flat for the year, which, again, is sort of quite surprising.
Oil and banks.
Yeah, right. Exactly, right. And the stuff that he can't buy and he wouldn't buy. And there's a little bit of trivia here in his top 10 holdings. You two, this is probably directed more at Angus and Richard, but Nisha, you might also know. Second largest position is a company called Croda International. Do you know what? Famously, they produced a cure for a particular type of disease. This is a specialist chemicals company. So famously produced, so none of you know, Lorenzo's oil. I was really hoping one of you would get that because I don't know because I'm not old enough. But yeah, great movie. Definitely consume that. That's of all his top positions, that's actually had the worst run year to date, down 25%. It's actually off 30% from its December highs, but has done well over the course of the pandemic.
Interesting. Chemicals is a positive sector for him. Even though some of the stuff...
These are very speciality chemicals. These are not fossil fuels or anything.
So, Nisha, just tell us a bit more about him. You say he's changed tech, he's gone down from tech. Where did he shift to? Was it healthcare or...?
So, I mean, he's been quite heavily in industrials for a long time. Some of his overweights are industrials. Healthcare, he's had a long standing. He's been... since I've been tracking him, he's always had an overweight position to healthcare. And one of his positions is AstraZeneca in his top 10. And, that's stayed since, I think, a long time, 2007, he first bought that one. So, it's a long mainstay in his portfolio. So, but he does have, underweight positions as well. Tech recently has gone down quite a bit. And that is because, some concerns, as I mentioned before, it is about the S of ESG, the data privacy, fake news. It impacts, socially, so, all these bigger companies, and then regulations on top of it. So, avoidance of those kind of stocks. But he did that quite early on anyway. So, in that kind of sense, he stuck with, the long-term players. He's not going to shift out in and out of these stocks. Yes, during the pandemic, he did, initiate two new positions within his top 10. But that is for a reason. He'll keep those for a long time within his portfolio. And basically, his highest conviction stocks, he will hold, above 3%. Anything else is not really a high conviction enough for him. And that's one of his stated objectives as well. Will be, if it's one of those percentages, he will have that. That is his high conviction area. And one thing I do want to mention is that pre 2009, he did have small cap stocks in his portfolio, but he's shifted that to large cap focus. And since then, he's become a large cap manager because of risk. And I said he's been in this for decades, so he knows when to move and keep your portfolio, riding along nicely over all the cycles. The last thing I just want to say about him, now this is my personal opinion, he's a great stock picker and he has rewarded investors. Now he sticks to his guns and is not swayed by market noise, and that's why I like him. A high conviction manager that delivers for the long term.
Excellent. Just before we go, and just to show we are doing this live on the day, we had today, sticking on the ESG, that Morningstar has booted out an extraordinarily large number. I think it's something like a quarter of so-called European sustainable funds, and said, you're not sustainable. I'm guessing, I don't know whether they've released the list. I'm guessing Mike Fox's funds are not being booted out. This is quite drastic, isn't it?
It's quite drastic, but I completely agree with it. I've had a bugbear for ages. For example, China funds being in there, for ESG credentials, the majority are Article 8 labeled funds. And for me, that was, a red light, that you need to look into this. Most of these companies state owned, what's going on with regulations out there, etc. We know the story about, China. So those funds, straight away, as soon as they were labeled Article 8, I was like, okay, so any fund can really be labeled an Article 8 then. That was my feeling behind it.
And Morningstar saying enough already.
We're going to call time.
Well, it's also a sign of things to come, isn't it? Because, so Nisha, correct me if this is wrong, but as I understand it, at the moment, it's down to the asset manager to self-declare whether a fund meets Article 8 criteria. The actual regulatory part of it, them being examined to see whether they do comply with the taxonomy, is yet to come. So if Morningstar have done this already, then that suggests that when it reaches the regulatory stage, I think is it July? Then I think we could see a little bit more bloodletting.
Yeah, it's in June 2022. It's been a moving part for about 2 years now. It was supposed to be happening in January. Now it's gone to June. But now it is the crux of it that they have to. It's mandatory. They will need to label their funds. Before, it was voluntary until the date was coming, you know, if they wanted to label them right now, for example, in the last year or so. But now it is, you know, I think it's the pedal is on the gas now.
Right. We will see that coming. Nisha, thank you very much for that really thorough analysis of Mike Fox. Sounds like, I think we all know him. He's walked the walk for the last 20 years and talking about ESG before anybody knew what it really stood for. So thank you for that. Thank you, Frank, and thank you for Angus. And thank you to everybody for listening to us, and we will be back again in a fortnight.